This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, neuroscientist James Fallon found something shocking when he was looking at brain scans of serial killers. We'll talk about his book, The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. We'll also find out what his research might tell us about Sandy Hook shooter Adam Lanza. But first, an Italian organization representing victims of asbestos exposure has asked Yale University to rescind an honorary degree awarded to the owner of a company that they once worked for. It's a story about what's called an environmental disaster, but it's also a story about whether one's good deeds and philanthropy can make up for a controversial past. Joining me to talk about the story is Diane Orson. She's WNPR's managing editor and the host of Morning Edition. She's been following the story of Stefan Schmidheimy. Tell me his story. Who is he, Diane?
Stefan Schmidheimy is a Swiss billionaire, and in the mid-1970s, he took over his family's business, which was called the Eternit Company. This was a company that had plants around the world that produced asbestos cement products. The largest was in Casale Monferrato, Italy, and for many decades, this plant used asbestos fiber in the manufacturing of its products. Eternit made things like cement board, cement pipe, corrugated sheets used in construction. And over time at this Italian plant, like many other asbestos plants around the world, workers started to develop diseases like asbestosis or lung cancer or malignant mesothelioma, which is a kind of cancer that's caused by exposure to asbestos. People inhale these asbestos particles. And the danger actually went beyond just to the workers at the plant, but extended to family members. For example, the wives of workers who were exposed to asbestos from the clothing that their husbands brought home also developed asbestos-related diseases, even people who happened to just live in the area around the asbestos plant were at risk. So, before we continue telling the story, let's listen to the Connecticut lawyer, Christopher Meisenkoth, and he's representing the Italian request to Yale pro bono.
1981, 5 years after Stefan Schmidheimy took over the family business, this plant in Casale was still using 15,000 tons, that's 30 million pounds, of asbestos annually in that plant. And 10% of that asbestos, 1,500 tons, was a type of asbestos called blue asbestos or chrysotile asbestos. And by 1981, it was well known and well established that not only could asbestos cause the full range of asbestos-related diseases, including malignant mesothelioma, but that the blue asbestos, the chrysotile asbestos, was the most potent form. It was extremely deadly.
In fact, Meisenkoth read to me from translations of meetings that took place in the 1970s where Eternit leaders, including Stefan Schmidheimy, acknowledged that their workers were at risk, but the plant continued to use asbestos for many years after that. There were ways they could have offered protective clothing, offered gear to their workers, but according to the workers at the time, no serious precautions were taken. It's also important to note that 2 years after he took over leadership of Eternit, Stefan Schmidheimy actually began to dismantle the asbestos portion of his plant, and in the eyes of some people, he's seen as a pioneer, as someone who was one of the first to recognize the risks of to human health of asbestos. He launched a program to start developing asbestos-free products, and he went on to use his wealth to support eco-friendly, sustainable development in Latin America and in other parts of the world.
Which is what brings us to the Yale connection, which we'll talk more about in a bit. And we're talking with Diane Orson here on Where We Live about this very interesting story about whether or not a man's company's past bad deeds might be erased in some way by the good deeds he does later. It's a very interesting story about asbestos and a large-scale environmental disaster. We want to bring in Barry Castleman, who's an environmental consultant. He was part of a trial against Stefan Schmidheimy. It resulted in Schmidheimy being found guilty of causing the deaths of the thousands of Italian citizens from this town and also creating what's called an environmental disaster. Barry Castleman, welcome to our program.
Hi.
I'm wondering if you can tell us what exactly happened at this trial in Italy.
Well, the Italians regard death on the job as potentially a criminal matter. And they looked into the question of whether the owners and executives of this enterprise, which was a vast company that had plants all over Europe and even in South America and South Africa, but particularly in Italy, whether they had taken reasonable steps to protect workers and the community, but mainly the workers, against what was then known among the industry about the lethality of asbestos. We're talking about the time that Stefan Schmidt-Heine took over as the chief executive officer in 1976. And they, you know, the trial concluded that they basically kept running the business pretty much as usual until it was no longer possible to sell asbestos. They were trying to convert to non-asbestos alternatives because they saw the writing on the wall. There was all kinds of controversy in some of the countries where they operated, as well as in the United States where they didn't operate, starting to bubble up in the 1970s. And that was the thing that drove them to look for substitute products and drove Mr. Schmidt-Heine to sell off the asbestos properties that he didn't convert to non-asbestos in the 1980s.
Now, you were an expert witness in this case. Tell us a bit about your role and whether or not you've done this in other cases as well about asbestos.
Yes, I wrote my doctoral thesis about the public health and corporate history of asbestos, and I've testified a lot in trials in the United States about that. I was invited by the community of Casale Monferrato, where this big plant in Italy was located, to testify in the criminal trial involving Mr. Schmidt-Heine. And so I basically gave a picture of what was known in the asbestos industry, the global industry, among the big companies, information that was demonstrably shared by them in the early 1970s at meetings that they held where Eternit officials, officials of Schmidt-Heine's company, were present.
Let's back up and talk about this lethal material, asbestos, a bit more, Barry, and you can explain exactly what it does. Diane had enumerated some of the medical conditions that can be caused by asbestos exposure, but explain exactly what it does if we inhale particulate matter from asbestos.
Well, the asbestos fibers, it's a mineral fiber in it, so it's dug out of the ground in places like Canada and Russia, South Africa. Small mines existed in the United States. And when the dust from the asbestos gets into the lungs, when we breathe this dust, it can cause either a lung scarring disease called asbestosis, which was thoroughly documented in scientific and medical literature by the end of the 1920s, and also it can cause various forms of cancer. And this was widely accepted in medical circles by the end of the 1940s, particularly lung cancer, and then mesothelioma in the early 1960s as an asbestos-specific type of cancer. And it was the mesotheliomas that enabled epidemiologists to show that the hazard was moving into the households of the workers and the neighborhoods of the factories in studies that were published in the mid-1960s.
Quickly, I want to go back to this trial that you were part of, Barry Castleman, against Stefan Schmidt-Heine and the work that his company did in Italy. Did he and his company offer compensation to those who were affected, or the families of those who died?
Only on the eve of trial, I think, were they trying to pay people off, and this was mainly to blunt the danger to Schmidt-Heine himself of the criminal prosecution and the appeal proceedings. So they wanted to reduce the number of parties that would be involved in appealing the judgment of the trial court. But generally speaking, there hasn't been much in the way of offers, as I understand.
So what usually happens in an asbestos trial like this? If someone is put on trial for having used or handled asbestos improperly and put people's lives in danger, are there usually fines? Are there prison sentences? What tends to happen?
Well, in Italy, they actually have prison sentences. They had already moved to prosecute some of the executives in Italy who were managing this enterprise starting in 1988, 2 years after the plant closed in Casale. And these individuals were convicted in 1999. Schmidt-Heine's people saw this as a possibility, at least, that the prosecutors might even go as far as to go after the foreign owner executives such as Schmidt-Heine himself and a Belgian baron who was initially his co-defendant in the criminal trial that went to verdict in 2012. And so back in 1992, you see their public relations people preparing documents and anticipating the possibility that this could go further.
So again, Stefan Schmidt-Heine, Diane, is sentenced to 16 years in prison, actually then turned to 18 years after appeal, something that's a little different than what happens in the United States system. So let's get this back to the United States and back to Connecticut and Yale University. The victims here say that Yale should reconsider whether or not Stefan Schmidt-Heine deserves an honorary degree that was awarded to him back in 1996.
That's right. They say, you know, Yale is one of the most prestigious institutions in the world, and Schmidt-Heine is now in Italy a criminal, and they're saying, you know, does he deserve this honorary degree? We did ask if someone from Yale's administration would join us for today's conversation. They declined, but they did send along a statement. And I can read a little bit from that.
Sure.
If you want. They said, you know, Yale awarded an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters degree to Stefan Schmidt-Heine for his advocacy of sustainable economic growth and development. The decision to award the degree was made by a committee that considered Mr. Schmidt-Heine's full record as a philanthropist who used his wealth to fund sustainable development in Latin America and elsewhere. He was a path-breaking international advocate of change in the way businesses address environmental sustainability, as well as a businessman who inherited and dismantled a decades-old family asbestos processing concern. Yale does not believe that the ongoing legal proceedings in Italy provide cause to reconsider the judgment made by the committee in 1996. Yale has never revoked an honorary degree, and any decision to do so would be made by the Yale Corporation. They go on to say that Yale has revoked a degree previously awarded only when there's been academic or other fraud.
Now, it's interesting, Diane. You and I have been covering Yale University for quite some time, and you've done a number of stories, including a long-term reporting project that you did about Yale and artifacts of Machu Picchu and whether or not those should be repatriated to the country of Peru. And one of the things we found is that while this statement from Yale is certainly what they believe to be their statement right now, once there's pressure that comes from inside the Yale community, sometimes minds are changed. So maybe you can talk a bit about what's happening within the Yale community right now or around this issue.
Well, I can tell you that I did speak with a Yale professor about this. He's a member of the philosophy department, and he says that the accusations deserve careful inquiry.
My name is Thomas Poggi, and I'm a professor in the philosophy department at Yale University. This is very important new information that I think at the very least should be looked at very carefully by the authorities at Yale. Yale has a very distinguished record, actually, in asbestos research, and we have the requisite expertise to convene an excellent faculty committee that could look into this case in more depth.
And in response to that idea of appointing a faculty committee to study this issue, lawyer Chris Meisenkoven says this.
Yale puts together a committee of qualified faculty members that can look at this impartially and give them a fresh perspective. And then if they decide at the end of the day that, you know, we still don't think anything should be done, you know, I may not like that, my clients may not like that, but so be it. At least Yale did the right thing and Yale took another look at it. And, you know, ultimately the question for Yale, I think, is, you know, obviously the threshold question of whether they will look at this again. But then, you know, if they do, does any subsequent good conduct, concern for the environment and ecological business practice, does that erase, can that greenwash Mr. Schmidt-Heine's prior history with the company?
I guess that's the question I want to put to you last, Barry Castleman, someone who's been called a philanthropist, who's funded sustainable development groups throughout the Americas. In your mind, as someone who understands the impact of what his company did with asbestos and how many people died as a result, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it caused thousands of deaths. The Italian appeals court judge that it put back the ban on asbestos in Italy by 10 years. If you commit armed robbery and kill people and then you use some of the money for good causes, that hardly erases the crime. I mean, this is a man who is charged with causing several thousand deaths because of the way he knowingly ran this business and knowingly was part of a cover-up that certainly didn't tell people how lethal this stuff was. I mean, there had been numerous studies showing that the household contact alone was sufficient to cause mesothelioma by the time he took over this business in 1976. So this is what Yale should consider.
And I just want to jump in and say that, zooming out a little bit, this story is not unique. There are a number of other asbestos manufacturing plants all around the world. As we mentioned, there are asbestos mines, shipyards. Even right here in Connecticut, there were places that were using asbestos. There was the Raybestos Manhattan facility in Stratford that produced asbestos brake linings. Also in Stratford, there was the Tylo company that made asbestos shingles. And over and over and over again, the story is the same, that exposure to asbestos has resulted in workers and their family members developing these asbestos-related diseases.
If you want to learn more about this story, you can find it at WNPR.org. Our reporter is Diane Orson, WNPR's managing editor. Thank you so much, Diane, for bringing this to us.
Thanks, John.
I also want to thank Barry Castleman, who's an environmental consultant who is an expert witness at this Schmidt-Heine trial in 2012. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a neuroscientist's look inside the psychopathic brain provided an eye-opening look at his own personality. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In 2005, neuroscientist James Fallon was looking at brain scans of serial killers, trying to find patterns that lined up with psychopathic tendencies. When he looked at a scan of his own brain, he found a lot of similarities. His book is called The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain. Our conversation with him comes only a few days after the release of thousands of pages of documents about the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary and the killer, Adam Lanza. We've learned a bit more about Lanza's medical treatment and behavior, but we still don't know what drove him to this terrible act. Later, we'll find out what Dr. Fallon's research might tell us about the Sandy Hook shooter, but first, we'll talk about what Fallon has learned about his own brain. James Fallon, welcome to Where We Live.
John, thanks for having me.
First of all, could you tell us what a psychopath is?
Yeah, a psychopath is a person with a personality disorder. There's about a dozen personality disorders, and it is something that's characterized by somebody who has several groups of traits. One group has to do with the way you treat other people, how you view other people. And a psychopath doesn't quite view other people as human beings like we would normally think of. They're more like objects, and they're objectified in how that person can use them. And so part of that is, you know, they're very good at reading people, normally, ones with average or above average intelligence. So they can read people, and they can read people's emotions. But the key thing is that even though they can understand seeing other people's emotions, they themselves do not have what's called emotional empathy. They don't feel others' pains. They understand it, though, and they know how to manipulate that. There's a whole part of psychopathy, and it's kind of controversial, and it's that part having to do with antisocial personality disorder. And a lot of the characterizations of psychopaths in film and TV, et cetera, are people with ASPD, antisocial personality disorder, as well as narcissism or malignant narcissism, because there's some overlap there. But they, you know, those are the criminal traits. There are a whole set of non-criminal traits, which is maybe more to core psychopathy, that has a lot to do with people who are, you know, glib, manipulative. They can lie very easily. They don't have a normal reaction to stress or anxiety like other people do at all. And they don't have a sense of guilt. That sense of guilt may have never developed at all because of the brain areas involved in that. And so there's a third set of traits having to do with sexual behavior, very promiscuous, do not have good long-term relationships, etc. And so there's about 20 of these traits.
So how did you first get involved and interested in studying this world and studying these different traits?
Well, from the time I was a kid, I was interested in science. And then after, during my late teens, I became very interested in neuroscience. And that was back in the late 60s. And I started out by studying kind of wet, hardcore neuroscience, if you will, brain physiology and anatomy. And that's what I've done a lot of my career. And then in the medical school that I taught in, I taught about the human brain. And the more I got into that, the more I was asked to be an advisor on certain things. And one was, beginning in the early 1990s, when we got a PET scanner, positron emission tomography scanner, to look at the functional scans of people's brains. One of the studies they were doing was on serial killers, hardcore murderers, and I was brought in to analyze what part of the brain was involved. So from about that time, from about the early 1990s, I've been looking at one or two of these guys a year, really hardcore murderers and serial killers. Then in about 2005, I got a whole bolus of scans from one researcher and then several others. And when I was looking at these, they were all mixed together. There were normal people scans, there were people with depression, people with schizophrenia, and then there was a whole group of them, about 30 in that particular group, that were murderers. And I was able to separate these out without knowing who was who. You know, it was a blinded study, which was the first full one I had done, and I continue to do those now. And I saw a pattern after several months of looking at these, and I never thought there was a pattern to, you know, a psychopath's brain. And so when I saw it, it pretty much startled me, because I said, there's something here. You know, there's an anatomical pattern in these scans. And during that time, I just happened to be doing, we were doing study on Alzheimer's disease, the genetics of Alzheimer's. We were doing PET scans with that too. And we had all the subjects we needed with Alzheimer's, but we needed control. So I asked my family if they wanted to be, you know, be a control group. We hadn't done a full family, and ones that did not have Alzheimer's. So, you know, I had my wife and our kids and my brothers and even my mother. We had them involved mainly because my wife's mother and father had died of Alzheimer's. And it was very prevalent in her family. And I said, you know, do you really want to do this? Because you could find out, you know, genetics or brain pattern that's going to be quite disturbing to you. And she was more than brave. I mean, she said, you know, because she had just gotten over non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she's got a, you know, she's got a very funny personality, a very enjoyable funny personality and a sense of humor. She says, look, I'm going to die of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma before I die of Alzheimer's. Let's do it, because then it could help the kids and how they, you know, live their lives, and it'll give a baseline, and their grandchildren. So we went ahead and did that. And after the results came back, I still had this pile of, you know, studies of these scans on my desk of the killers, and the technician brought in my family scans. I said, here they are, and I quickly looked through them to look for any obvious patterns, and they were coded, so I didn't know who was who. And the whole pile went through. They looked normal. I was so happy, because that meant that there was no obvious evidence that we didn't have any genetics in yet, but there was no evidence from the PET scans that there was any Alzheimer's that was there. But I got to the bottom scan, and it was really, really abnormal. And it not only was it abnormal, because it had no function at all shown in key areas of the frontal and temporal lobes, and it looked exactly like a scan of, like, the worst murderers I had been studying, the worst psychopaths. So it was like, I asked the technician, I said, you got to check this. This is obviously in the wrong pile. And he went back and checked, went to the machine, and he came back. He says, no, he says, that's your somebody in your family. So I had to, like, break the code on that one. I peeled off the tag on it, and it was me.
The amazing thing about this that you outline in your book, though, is that while this comes as a shock, as a surprise to you, as you begin piecing together many of your interpersonal relationships and other information that you can gather in other ways, the fact that your brain might align with a psychopath's brain becomes not, I suppose, quite so surprising to you. Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about then what you had to learn after you learned that your brain is an awful lot like those of serial killers.
Sure. You know, John, it was kind of a step-by-step process, because when I first saw the scan, I just laughed. And in fact, the technician who knows me well laughed too. We just thought it was funny. But then the genetics came back a few months later, and the same thing happened. And my family had a balance of all these aggression or warrior genes of high and low aggression, high and low, you know, emotional empathy and response to anxiety, et cetera, except the last one again, and it was me. So I had inherited all of these genetic alleles that very much aligned with psychopathy. And so I had the two key biological markers, which, you know, were proposed, that is the brain pattern and the genetics. And about the same time, I happened to, we had a party at my house, and My mother came over, and she says, you got to look at this. It's a historical book that just came out. It's called Killed Strangely, and she says, it's about your father's family. So we're sitting at the end of the party having a set, and she says, check this out. And it was the direct grandfather family, the Cornells, of my father and me, and it was the first case of a son killing a mother, matricide, in the colonies. It was back in 1667. But she says, no, read on. So at the end of the book, there were several more murderers who were the direct grandfather's line. And that ended in the book, the discussion, at the end of the 19th century with Ezra Cornell, right? He's a cousin, and he started Cornell University, so I was quite happy about that. But in the same breath, another cousin is my cousin Lizzie Borden. And at the same time, we had started this adult stem cell company for treating a long-term stroke and Parkinson's. And the CEO that I invested in this startup, he goes, you got to give a TED talk on something. So I gave the TED talk, and there was a response. And 3 months after that, I started to get responses. People saw the TED talk and who knew me and who knew, were also experts in either in psychiatry or the frontal lobe. They said, your frontal lobe is really alarmingly abnormal. And so a couple of them said, check these other genes. And I they were right. I had these genes. So this may have happened in utero. That is, since I had inherited such a disproportional number of these genes associated with psychopathy and aggression and violence, that it may have developed, you know, in utero. So at that point, it started to get serious. But I gave a talk in Oslo with the ex-prime minister on depression. We gave a public series of three talks. And in the audience were several experts in psychiatry and bipolar and psychopathy. And they started talking during the lecture. They said, first of all, do you know you're bipolar? I go, no. They started to talk to me afterwards. And they said, you really may have a problem. And at that point, the whole thing got serious. And when I went back and started to talk to all the psychiatrists and geneticists I knew personally for many years and who knew my behaviors and some of my not-so-charming behaviors, I said, what do you think of me? I said, I heard this. It's crazy. He goes, so, Jim, we've been telling you for years you have these psychopathic traits. And I thought you said I was crazy. They go, no, you're psychopathic. And I went, you got to be kidding. And that opened up this whole can of worms. And then I asked, you know, my family and people very close to me, people I grew up with, and they all said the same thing. And this was really a surprise to me. I had never thought of myself that way at all.
And when you talk about doing things, you're talking about some of these behaviors you discussed earlier, being manipulative, perhaps lacking empathy.
Oh, yeah, because it's hard when you're in your own mind, even though I'm kind of studying this, you know, you don't really know who you are because you're seeing it from a completely a blurred filter. And so when I looked at the behavior of people and my behavior, how I treat people that I'm supposed to love who are very close to me versus strangers, as it turns out, my actual behavior, not what I thought I was, but what everybody thought I was and what it was actually behaving, was if I didn't care any more about people who were very close to me than complete strangers. And so, but I was involved in many, many, you know, good works and charity and everything. But, you know, if you look at people like Gandhi and Mother Teresa, and then just recently what Mandela's daughter said about him, there's that kind of empathy, which is called cognitive empathy. And that's, I do have cognitive empathy, and I'm very sympathetic, but I'm not empathetic, nor it seems were they. People pointed out to me that it's sort of a Buddhist thing, which also I thought was, I couldn't even believe my ears, but I was told that by a psychiatrist after a couple of talks I gave in India. They said, yeah, you have this emotionally flat world where you treat everybody the same. And that's not, see, that seems like a good thing, except if you're married to somebody like that, or if you're the son or daughter or mother or father of somebody like that, it's a very, very disappointing thing because, in fact, they nor I, not that I'm Gandhi, but, I, you know, that particular trait, you just don't treat your family well at all. You treat them no better than anybody else. Here's the thing. Every time I meet somebody, I try to get them to jump into my world and to believe this whole thing. And I do that by telling the truth, not by lying. But I realize that I've always gotten all the prestige and the power and all the ego strokes that I've ever wanted. So I didn't need that. But what I was doing and what I have to fight doing is to create this world of truths that are there to manipulate people into completely believing my little world at that moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do. I create a little psychopathic world. When I'm interacting with somebody, I get a buzz out of it. And even though I don't ever try to, you know, it's not like I try to have sex with them or get money from them. I don't need that stuff. But what if I did? I was thinking, what if I did need that stuff? And I wasn't, as it turns out, brought up in such a loving environment. And I had everything, you know, and I'm somebody that never believed in that. I always believed genetics ruled everything. So I started to think maybe I was wrong. And I'm telling you, I do not like to ever admit that I'm wrong, but it was there. The evidence was there, and it hit me personally. And I realized my assumptions about, you know, the development of behavior and who you are was quite different than what I had always thought and professed. And so the whole thing came quite a crashing down on me, and I asked for it.
Coming up, James Fallon talks about what his brain research says about serial killers and psychopaths and what it might tell us about Newtown shooter Adam Lanza. Stay with us where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, the Cold War is long over, but some political relationships in the former Soviet Union remain tied to that old conflict. On the next Where We Live, we'll explain the latest turmoil in Ukraine, where Russia and the European Union are pulling the country in opposite directions. All this comes as the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, are just weeks away. Join us on the next Where We Live. You can always join us online at WNPR.org. Today we're joined by neuroscientist James Fallon, author of The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain. So far, we've discussed Fallon's personal journey in discovering and recognizing the psychopathic traits exhibited in his own brain. Now I want to shift the conversation and talk about what we know and don't know about a different brain, that of Newtown school shooter Adam Lanza. We talked to Fallon just a few days after the final police report on the shootings was released. We learned a bit more about Lanza in those reports. Beyond his primary diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum, he was also diagnosed with obsessive-compulsive disorder, something written about extensively in Fallon's book. We learned more about Lanza's social detachment and lack of the kind of nurturing environment that James Fallon himself had growing up. We also learned that Lanza lacked theory of mind, the ability to see others as real people. I asked James Fallon whether, knowing these things in advance, if we might have been able to predict Adam Lanza's behavior, or whether Fallon's own research might be used to stop killers in the future.
John, as I mentioned in my book, I went through a very strong clinical period of OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, around the time of puberty. Now, that morphed into panic attacks later on, and when my behavior really changed when I was about 19 or 20. I read the report that came out on Adam, and I looked at it. Now, I can't say clinically really what he had, of course.
Yes.
So we have to acquiesce to the clinical diagnoses that were given. But that Asperger's thing sometimes can be misdiagnosed, because I have a bunch of Asperger's, but I know what people – I really use what I know about other people. I know what tend to know what they're thinking and their emotional state, but I don't care. And that can look like Asperger's in a way, because, you know, there's this idea of theory of mind or the mirror neuron system. And I would say we don't have a scan, like you said, but, you know, like me, I have a very strong, you know, mirror neuron system. I can understand people's moves, what they're doing. I'm a natural athlete because of that. I'm not a very good athlete, but I'm a natural athlete because of that. And I'm able to read people. So when I read that, I understood, you know, the OCD part and also what appeared to be Asperger's. And I just don't know if that's true, because, like I said, this other thing that psychopaths have, which is really an abnormal sense of mind in the sense that they can't feel what others do, so people just appear as objects to use to them. Well, the difference is, and like what I concluded, you know, the kind of working hypothesis in my case, is that I had an especially nurturing bringing up. I was wedged between an older brother 5 years ahead of me and a younger brother almost 5 years behind me. So I was, and there were so many miscarriages in between. When I was born, I was really like a golden child because my family wanted a big, you know, family, even though it had nothing to do with my behavior. It was just that I was born. I didn't die. I wasn't miscarried. And then my mother told me a little over a year ago when I was writing the book other things that she'd never said to anybody. And how strange I was around the time of puberty. I was not only had OCD, but I regressed, and I went from a very social, happy kid to a kind of a dark character who didn't talk to anybody for many months. This wasn't just the normal sort of change that occurs during puberty. It went on way too long, and it was a severe change in behavior. But my mother, she said, at the time she didn't want to get a psychiatrist to, you know, even though we were friends with one. Or tell my father, she said, just worked it out. So I think she was really especially watched out and had teachers who she knew watch out that I wasn't bullied and all that stuff. And I, after that very dark period, I was lucky enough to be born. I was good looking. I was, you know, like 6 foot, about 190, and was a good athlete, good enough, I guess, to play, and was popular. So even though I had very strange thoughts, I had such a rich social life and had such a nurturing family. In an extended family, everybody just treated me wonderfully.
Let me ask you, though, something. If you are able to, say, look at a brain of someone who has many of the same genetic tendencies, biological tendencies that you have, but then is in a non-nurturing environment versus someone like yourself who grew up with this great family structure around you, I mean, James, does the brain change? I mean, can the brain chemistry actually change based on how you are treated, how you're raised?
Yes. As it turns out, yes. And, you know, we're born with the set of DNA that we inherit. And those genes, that's your genome. But there's this thing called the epigenome. The epigenome is what actually ends up being turned on and off of your genes. So even though you have these genes, they could be turned on and off. And the stressors, especially early on, there's two major points in your lifetime where this is very key. One is right after fertilization. That's when a lot of this epigenome effects can take place due to, let's say, maternal stress and, you know, external stressors. That's when they can really be turned on and off. But another key one is right around the time you're born. At birth, if you are subjected to stress, either, you know, like in the third term of pregnancy or at birth or right after, a lot of stressors. It could be abandonment. It could be physical, sexual abuse, mental abuse. From that right around that point is can be devastating. And that was not really known until the last couple of years that there's that key point around the time of birth. We knew there were critical periods, but it turns out they're really critical. And so for the first months up until about a year and a half, you're very susceptible to abandonment and early abuse, and that's a key thing. And, you know, so when I'm asked to, you know, discuss people who were murderers or rapists or something like that, or even dictators, I look to that very early period, because most of the time we never have the genetics. It's got to be inferred. So you got to look at the whole family, especially on the mother's side if it's a male, and look at those early stressors and the abandonment, and that seems to be key. And what happens is that stressors, let's say it could be the mother's drinking or drug use, or, you know, or just abandonment, or, you know, being abused, yelled at, and, you know, severely, not being disciplined, but being really abused and hit early on. What happens is that the stressors release a chemical that adds methyl groups. It's a very simple methyl group. It's a carbon with four hydrogens on it, and that methylation of genes turns the ones you have on and off. And you can turn on, leaving on genes that can really be pernicious in behavior and result in more aggression and violence, or can turn off those genes that mellow you out, so to speak. And so it's like selecting and picking from a whole banquet certain foods that can be quite bad for you. And that's what seems to happen. It's that early couple of years is so critical.
So if you look around the general population, people walking down the street every day, two questions for you here, James Fallon. One is, how many of us have these same psychopathic tendencies that you found in yourself and that you also found in these serial killers? And if indeed there's a certain number of us walking around, what's the chances that anyone's going to act violently on that? I mean, is violence necessarily aligned with the psychopathic mind?
The answer is to that question is no, but it can express itself as extreme aggressiveness. But, you know, it can be violence, too. If you look at psychopathy as a categorical definition, and you know, juries, insurance companies, everybody likes categorical sorts of names for things because they're easy. So you say, am I a psychopath or not? And that's the wrong question. The question is, how much of the traits do you have that make up a psychopath? This is one of the reasons why psychopathy or sociopathy is not even included in the official manual for psychiatry and psychology, the DSM-5. It overlaps with too many other things like, malignant narcissism. There are other personality disorders. So it doesn't seem to be one exact thing. So it's not even considered a psychiatric problem. Can you believe it? But part of it is the antisocial personality disorder part, the ASPD part, is considered in psychiatry. But that's only one-third, and that's the part that has to do with criminality. There are all these other traits where you can walk around and never have criminal problems, but be very manipulative and really be destructive in people's lives. And those are the people that are more dangerous, if you will, to the general public, because there's so many more of them. So if you look at categorical psychopaths, there's about 1% of females and about 2% of males in the population are categorical. But if you look at those people that are near psychopaths or just borderline, there's many more of them. And it probably more up to 5-6%. That's, you know, people like me. And it just depends on how far down, you know, how far on the scale you want to go on these traits, and to determine how many, you know, near psychopaths there are. So you could say 5 or 8% like that. That's a lot of people, actually. But, you know, the ones that are just are psychopaths categorically that score, you know, 28 or higher on Robert Hare's test of psychopathy, well, for those, there are fewer. And of those, it's not really known how many of the serial killers are that, because there's so few of them. Or so few of these people who do these horrendously violent things that are hard to understand. So we don't have enough data to really say, to give the right answer now. It's very understudied. And in fact, there's almost nothing known genetically or about the brain patterns. This is all inferred. See, I'm telling you the best story I can, but it's, you know, other people who study this are now, we all kind of agreeing what the problem is. But just because a number of the experts agree on it doesn't mean it's true, because we haven't really tested it. You know, part of it is due to the legal system. You can't get to the DNA. You know, these cases are closed. They're locked, you know. And so a lot of that information on early behavior, really happened in the family, those kind of interviews, in getting the genetics is almost impossible. And it's really impeded the answer to your question. And, the question is, could we have known, if we knew about Adam's genetics in his brain pattern, and then had somebody had been alerted to it, could we have predicted based on his early behavior and his genetics? The answer is probably yes. And here's the thing: I have a problem. I'm, you know, politically a libertarian, so I don't like anybody messing with anybody, you know, personally. But on the other hand, this has become such a big social problem. Not only with terms of the murders, but it doesn't take many people to really destroy a community, as you well know. And so, you know, how do you sort of adjudicate that between the public trust and also individual protecting the individual? Well, we do have safeguards in place now for protecting that sort of information. If it could be protected, that is, the parents are they know something's in their family, and they know perhaps they know some of the genetics, or they're just looking at a kid's early behavior, because some psychiatrists and psychologists can see a very young primary psychopath at 2 years old, and they can just they say this kid's in trouble. Well, you know, there's not enough of those experts, but if a parent could meet with a health professional who's, you know, who's savvy on this and have it be very private. I think it would be useful because that kid could then have, if they wanted to, if it was, you know, some of the genetics done and some of the really more formal testing done, to see if the person is at risk genetically and behaviorally. Now, in my case, I have all the earmarkings of somebody who would have been really, really bad growing up, but it was as if, like my mother, she knew what was going on in a sense and was such keen, she was a teacher too, was such a keen student of behavior. She saw this.
That's really, I think, the key point to your book and how it aligns with some of what we're trying to figure out here in Connecticut and in the wake of all this is this sense that if you did know, if you could know all this information about every child in the world as they were born and try to figure out who might have these tendencies, one way that we could go is we might think that that makes our world a lot safer, but it may very well, as you suggested earlier, impinge on an awful lot of people's liberties with the idea that if we treated these people more aggressively, then we wouldn't have the worry of mass murderers walking amongst our midst. I think the thing that your book kind of teaches us is that given the right set of circumstances, some of these same behavioral tendencies can be funneled into someone who's a best-selling author and neuroscience researcher. It seems as though there's probably some positives of the psychopathic brain that we overlook when we think about serial killers.
Yeah, John, that's true, and this was a surprise for me as this developed. We do have the answer. The answer is that you keep kids away from bullying, we keep them away from abuse, but if they're brought up in a family that has, you know, generations of this, or even, you know, with a father who beats them or the mother who's always choosing the wrong kind of mate, if you will, you can see these behaviors, and we know that you can get somebody with all these who's kind of a genetically, if you will, in the brain patterns of a primary psychopath ready to go. If these kids are kept away from all of the abuse and the bullying and the, you know, the abandonment, frankly, that this is a way that the person will still have traits of, they may be very aggressive, they may be very manipulative, they may be great salesmen, but they don't have this need, they don't try to get even for their shortcomings, and they can funnel this into something very creative. Now, I'll just give you one maybe what quirky thing. There is a test of psychopathy called the PPI. That's the name of the test. People can take it online. And that PPI, one of the groups of traits has to do with what would be called fearless dominance. And that's what psychopaths have. They have this fearless dominance of other people. They're not scared. They go in and they don't have no problem manipulating people. They're fearless in many ways. Well, this test was given to all the biographers of our presidents to go through the checklist of all their behaviors and line that up against the perception by experts and the public of their leadership skills. And lo and behold, you know, the top scorers in this psychopathy, the fearless dominance, top one was Teddy Roosevelt, the second was JFK, the third was FDR. These are people who are known to be, you know, in another like scoundrels, right? But because it worked, FDR lied to the public, but he ended up saving the country. So we would say that's okay. Just like people want to have, if there's a scoundrel, they want to have that scoundrel working for them. It's almost like the public looks up to those behaviors as long as it wins for them. And so, you know, one of my conclusions is that, we, you know, in a way we ask for it. And so we think we don't like psychopathic traits, but there's a group of them we really do like, and we value them.
Mm. The book is called The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain, and the author is James Fallon. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. This has been a pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Where We Live's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.